Battening down the hatches in Beaumont and across large parts of coastal Texas as a hurricane named Laura intensifies in the Gulf. The latest on today's Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Across the Golden Triangle, evacuation orders take hold in advance of what meteorologists say could be a major hurricane threatening coastal Texas and Louisiana. We'll check in with officials in Beaumont. Also, neither snow nor rain nor what about Congress? Texas lawmakers and the politics of the Postal Service in advance of Election Day. Plus, the first and oldest hospital in the Americas. All that and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 25th day of August 2020. I'm David Brown. Many of us have that date, August 25th, etched in our memories. That was the day in 2017 that a hurricane named Harvey rammed the middle Texas coast, beginning a lengthy and destructive stay over southeast Texas that people still haven't fully recovered from. 3 years on, in places like the Golden Triangle of Orange, Port Arthur, and Beaumont, the scene is eerily reminiscent today as a storm named Laura bears down on the Gulf, intensifying and expected to reach hurricane strength by the time it meets the shore, now expected in the wee small hours of tomorrow morning. But precisely where along that shore remains a question mark at this hour. Weather models predict it could be anywhere along a line from central Louisiana to eastern Texas. In Beaumont, officials are taking no chances. Shortly before we went to air today, we reached out to police there, and you could tell that officials were already scrambling for information and putting action plans into place as they tried to prepare the community for the worst.
This is someone else's office. There's people in mine. We're all in an area where we can't. Does anybody know if it's raining yet?
That's Carol Riley of the Beaumont Police, who as of this morning has been deployed to serve as spokesperson for the City of Beaumont Emergency Management Department. As the city battens down the hatches for Laura's arrival. Officer Riley, thanks for taking a few minutes out to update us. Much appreciated.
Yes, you're welcome. Good morning.
What's your current understanding of when Hurricane Laura may hit Beaumont and the impact it's going to have?
Well, this area, this thing keeps changing, so it's very unpredictable. But right now we're planning for tropical storm force winds to start hitting us Wednesday morning, possibly Wednesday around noon. We're preparing for a lot of different scenarios, as well as hurricane force winds that we know will be coming behind those. So the actual hurricane to pass through, if it does hit our area, sometime Thursday morning around 1 or 2 in the morning.
Now, it's my understanding that Galveston's mayor and Port Arthur's mayor have issued mandatory evacuations for their cities. What are you looking at there in Beaumont? Are there mandatory evacuation orders yet?
Yes. Jefferson County Judge Jeff Brannick ordered mandatory evacuation for all of Jefferson County, and the cities, of course, have followed suit. And at 6:30 this morning, our plans were all activated. We currently have our traffic planning place for evacuation, and we're working on assembly sites and embarkation locations where we can get people that have absolutely no other options than to be bused out of the area. We are encouraging people to use any other forms of transportation because it's not a comfortable trip. It's, you know, sometimes really long. You're limited to one bag. If you have animals, there's a lot of restrictions there. So we ask people, we plan all year, and our area sadly is used to storms and hurricane season. So we put a lot of that out, and we ask our residents that are able to take care of themselves to please do that voluntary evacuation when they can, so we can take care of those that need our help the most.
Well, of course, this is an evacuation like no other, especially with COVID-19. How is the pandemic complicating that effort?
It is proving to be challenging, but you know, we have been working on that. We've been meeting and putting plans in place for some time. It does require that we use some social distancing measures. It limits the amount of people that we're able to put in locations, transport, and, you know, we have to provide additional things like masks and sanitizers. And, you know, we feel confident that, you know, we have a lot of measures in place and we're doing everything we can to make sure our citizens are safe.
So is the idea that if you can't evacuate, that what, you call the police department and ask for a bus or you meet at a certain terminal? What are the logistics of that?
Okay, so we've been pushing out messages via press release, Facebook, all social media, telling the public different locations they can go to. I'm sorry, every phone in here and all of them are going off.
I understand.
But we've been pushing out messages telling people where they can meet up. Our city buses started running at 6 o'clock this morning. If you live along the route, you can step out and wait for the bus. If they pass by your location, they'll pick you up there. Mm-hmm. And then we have 9 different locations that we have released where people can go and be transported to Westbrook High School. From Westbrook High School, they'll be transported to locations outside of the city that'll take them to safety.
I know this area has been hit hard recently by storms like Harvey and Imelda. Do you think you're better prepared for Laura because of those experiences?
We have a lot of experience in our Office of Emergency Management. Most of the people that are handling business here have been through numerous storms, including Rita, Katrina, Ike. So we have a lot of experience, but we learn and we have things we take from each incident to improve on and do better for our community.
Officer Carol Riley is a member of the Beaumont Police Department and spokesperson for the City of Beaumont Emergency Management Department. Officer Riley, it sounds very busy there. Thanks so much for your time and stay safe.
Thank you.
As funding for the Postal Service becomes another flashpoint ahead of the November presidential election, concerns about delays in mail services have been at the heart of congressional hearings with the U.S.'s Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy. DeJoy testified that changes implemented during the pandemic, he says, were cost-cutting measures, will be reversed, but wouldn't replace mail sorting machines and collection boxes already removed. On Saturday, the U.S. House voted to send $25 billion to the U.S. Postal Service and reverse operational changes that have slowed the mail service, at least through the end of the year. So reports Abby Livingston of the Texas Tribune, and she joins us now from Washington. Abby, thanks for taking a few minutes out to talk with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
How is all this playing out in Washington? There's one view on the House side, another on the Senate, and where do Texas lawmakers stand here?
Well, just like about everything in American politics, it mostly falls along partisan lines. And so Democrats have been raising Cain over this issue. There have been reports, including Congressman Joaquin Castro, who had a postal union leader tell him that mail that was should have been delivered months ago, tens of thousands had been hidden from him while touring a facility in San Antonio. On the flip side, Republicans say this is much ado about nothing. They call it a conspiracy theory. They call it fear mongering. And, you know, this is one of those things like I just defer to Texans to say, are you getting your mail on time? And that's the proof in the pudding.
Very interesting. There's a lot of anxiety, of course, because of the possible implications for November. Are you hearing any concerns expressed by members of the Texas delegation that this could, in fact, complicate the election count?
Absolutely. And you're hearing it from some of the highest levels of the Democratic Party as well beyond Texas. And so they had an entire hearing yesterday about it. They put the newish Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, before Congress. And I don't think it was the most pleasant experience for him. And I don't think he left Democrats feeling any better about the situation than when he came in.
But you were writing over the weekend that Will Hurd and Michael McCaul, two Republicans, would break from their party and actually vote for a USPS rescue bill. Where does that stand?
Well, it's probably going to be dead on arrival on the Senate side. And the only way this would get past President Trump, he's pretty much indicated he would veto it, is a two-thirds override in each chamber, which I don't think is going to happen. I think the hearing yesterday was more about educating the American public. But at the same time, this was in the middle of the day and there was all kinds of other crazy going on in politics. And I'm not sure how much it broke through.
Very interesting. So right now, I mean, the Postmaster General has tried to give assurances to members of Congress that there will be no slowdown in mail. Is it your sense that politicians, for the most part, are willing to accept that at face value, or will this controversy continue on Capitol Hill as you see it?
Well, it's going to be doubtful how frequently Congress is in session between now and the election. They generally go home in the fall of an election year anyway to campaign. So I'm not sure how much is to be done. I think this continues to be an issue if constituents don't get their mail. If they do, I think it'll fade away just like so many other controversies. But I think it's when the rubber hits the road and people are or are not receiving their medications and things that they need for life, I think that is going to determine the trajectory of this.
Abby Livingston has been reporting on the politics of the Postal Service for the Texas Tribune, and we're going to link to her latest over at texasstandard.org. Abby, thanks so much for the update.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, the politics of the Postal Service. Mm-hmm. Once upon a time, the post office was considered to be one of the most apolitical departments in all of government.
Not but there a hotbed of controversy, no sir. But we are, no. Yes, indeed, we are hearing from our friends and listeners about that story, David. Mm-hmm. How we just heard about Postmaster General Louis DeJoy's withering questioning in Congress yesterday over the crisis with the mail service. Via Twitter, Johnny D. says, DeJoy is a multimillionaire. He's used to people bowing to his every whim and getting his way regardless. People like this can't work for the general public as they're accustomed to never being held accountable. You know, David, we're also tracking the situation along the Gulf Coast as Hurricane mm-hmm. Laura gathers strength. We heard about the situation in Beaumont at the top of the show. Here's what some folks in the Galveston region are saying on Twitter, and for the most part, it seems like they're taking things in stride. DBSL Kitties says, I guess I better finish my coffee and start doing more hurricane prep. Slightly sadder story here via Twitter from Kalo. She tweets that there's a mandatory evacuation order by noon for the Galveston Island, but her work says we'll have to use paid time off if we want to leave at noon today to prepare our homes or evacuate. Wow. Looking to the politics of this situation, Haircut Hippie, he tweets that he is literally evacuating now because he's in the mandatory zone. He notes that the fact that the government can't agree on the dike, the so-called Ike Dike, while a hurricane is literally en route is very funny to him, I think, in a pointed sense there. And Chris Tipton says, I got to say my current life as consumed by a possible major hurricane is odd, seeing that most of my Twitter feed is carrying on as normal. Calls the situation surreal. Definitely a surreal situation for those folks scrambling to get out of the coastal region.
Taking a look at the Houston Chronicle, they have a Texas flood map and tracker that's keeping up with real time. It's a very revealing map that shows parts of Galveston and up toward Beaumont very much at risk. Keep it here for the latest.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Before the pandemic, over 1 million people in Harris County didn't have health insurance, which blocked them from easy access to health care. Now that lack of health insurance may be keeping more people from coronavirus testing. Houston Public Media's Sarah Willa Ernst has been exploring the challenges uninsured people in Houston face to find a test when they need it the most.
Frank De Oro is about to get a COVID-19 test for the second time this summer.
I just arrived at one of the signature care sites.
The first time was in mid-June, at the same place near the Galleria, and it ended up costing him $175. He paid the cost because he needed the results fast.
I only went to go get tested because I was going to go visit my family. They live in Brownsville, Texas, by the border, by the sea.
And it was a good thing it only took 45 minutes to get his results back. He was in his car.
And as I was waiting there, I was in the hall with one of my friends. And yep, it said that my results came back positive. And we were about to hang out. We were about to have lunch that day.
De Oro canceled his plans that would have exposed both his friend and his mom back in Brownsville. He started self-isolating that day. De Oro is one of millions who make up the largest uninsured population in the country. According to U.S. Census data, 20% of Texans and 22.6% of people in Harris County don't have insurance. widespread job losses have only increased those numbers. Without insurance, Deodoro decided to pay out of pocket for his tests, even though just a couple miles away, there was a free public testing site. He didn't go there because of its reputation.
I heard it from close friends that we would like send messages to each other. Like, oh yeah, I heard that my aunt right now has COVID-19, but they're not getting the results until like 7 days or 10 days.
These free sites are geared for people without insurance. But there are other invisible costs. Depending on the site, they show up in the time people take off of work to wait on long lines or to quarantine at home, sometimes without paid leave, as they wait for their test results.
It was a big waiting game.
This is Broderick Sanford Jr. He has insurance, but a high deductible of a couple thousand dollars.
I guess you would call me underinsured.
So he decided to get a free test at Houston ISD's Butler Stadium 2.5 months ago. And the results just never came. Sanford had mild symptoms and was concerned about dipping into his vacation days in order to quarantine.
I couldn't just sit at home waiting for results, not knowing how long it would be because I do have a job.
He ended up getting another free test, this time at CVS, with a 14-day turnaround. All in all, it took Sanford 29 days to finally get a result. He was able to postpone his return to the office until his negative results arrived. But that's not the case for everyone. Dr. Brian Reed is with Lone Star Circle of Care, a clinic that serves primarily uninsured individuals.
I've had some patients, and I say, well, you know, based upon what you're telling me, I think you need to get tested. And they'll tell me, no, I don't want to get tested. I mean, so, you know, they don't want to have that positive result, and they don't want to have all the stuff that goes with being positive.
Dr. Reed says inequity in healthcare has long plagued the state, and now it's making it harder to test Texans for the coronavirus.
Compared to some of the other industrialized, you know, nations or westernized nations, we were already kind of starting at a disadvantage, at least here in Texas, because of the numbers of people that are uninsured.
And getting fast results can help flatten the curve. Frank Deodoro got his second test 1.5 weeks ago. He felt it was worth it to pay another $175.
If I would have gone to visit my family, I would have contaminated my mother, and then if she would have interacted with my other family members, that would have been horrible.
This time, he tested negative. And that evening, Deodoro was on the road to finally see his mom for the first time since New Year's. I'm Sarah Willa Ernst in Houston.
Sarah Willa Ernst is a core member with Report for America, a national service program that places journalists into local newsrooms.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. While some school districts across Texas are completing back-to-school plans, schools in Lubbock welcomed students back to campuses last week. Not all teachers were on board with returning. In fact, as Casey Ellingson of Texas Tech Public Media reports, some even chose to resign.
You know, what happens when a product starts being...
It's the first day of in-person classes in over 5 months at Lubbock Cooper High School. It's a different return from summer for economics teacher David Ring. And it's not just because he's teaching in a new school district this year.
This class is about the same size as my previous one. Last year I had 38 students in about a class this size, and I couldn't walk among them. They were, you know, desk to desk. I've done my best to set up as much as I can 6-foot distancing.
There are 24 seniors in this class. Several wear their white Class of 2021 t-shirts, accessorized with a mask, but not everyone is wearing one. They're spaced out as much as possible. A white bucket at the entrance of the classroom has sanitizing wipes and extra masks beside it. Aside from these small pieces of sanitary evidence, it's easy to forget the pandemic exists, but it does.
Our main job is to educate, but I think as most people know, that's not all we do. We are amateur psychologists and sociologists and sometimes fill-in guardians.
Now, additional duties include cleaning desks between classes, monitoring bathroom capacity, and distributing hand sanitizer to students.
I don't think I would have come back had I not been comfortable with what they're doing here.
Great job, man.
Not everyone is comfortable with what their schools are doing. Lubbock Cooper ISD was the third district in the city to return to in-person instruction last week. Teachers say that the road to reopening was not a smooth one. Throughout the summer, districts around the state struggled to keep up with contradictory messages from the Texas Education Agency, or TEA, regarding reopening. The final state guidelines came in the middle of July, a month before school started in Lubbock. This left a lot of teachers frustrated. Some even felt disregarded.
Honestly, if our district had decided to start virtually, I would not have been looking for other jobs.
That's a former Lubbock ISD teacher. She doesn't feel comfortable with us using her real name, so we'll call her Anne. She resigned from Lubbock ISD over the summer.
Teaching is hard, and I had a pretty heavy workload, and I was very nervous about what the district was pursuing going forward in teaching with the pandemic and like the lack of teacher voice.
I've had a few resign or retire.
That's Clinton Gill. He's the Lubbock ISD representative for the Texas State Teacher Association, or TSTA. He's gotten a lot of feedback from teachers regarding returning to school.
Oh yeah, that's all I've dealt with probably the last 4 weeks.
The district involved teacher associations like TSTA in their planning committee in an effort to get unified teacher feedback. Clinton Gill was part of that committee.
There was a good mixture that wanted to go back and were ready to go back. And then there were quite a few as well that just concerned going back.
Gill sent a survey to Lubbock ISD teachers about reopening. He used it to help inform the committee on behalf of teachers. Ultimately, the push for in-person school came from necessity.
70% of our kids, whose parents wanted and needed face-to-face.
That's Lubbock ISD Superintendent Kathy Rollo.
Over 72% of our students are living in poverty, and they don't always have the support systems that they need to successfully navigate remote learning.
This, I think, if nothing else, has shed light on the complexities of public ed.
Here's David Ring again.
I think it's a great opportunity for us to look at public education differently and hopefully maybe hit the reset button and see how we're going to move forward and what we're going to expect of educators.
Anne doesn't regret her decision to leave teaching. On the first day of school, she sent her former colleagues a text saying, good luck, and carried on with her new workload. For this story, I spoke with 6 current and former teachers of Lubbock ISD who did not feel comfortable going on the record out of concern of retaliation. In Lubbock, I'm Casey Ellingson.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, offering annual preventative and screening appointments with safety protocols in place. Early detection is critical to better cancer outcomes. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. State prison officials are evacuating several facilities in southeast Texas in response to Hurricane Laura. Jeremy Diesel is with the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. He explained in a video what COVID-19 precautions were in place when the agency transferred more than 3,000 prisoners to other sites yesterday.
So, for example, we use a compound called vital oxide, which is an electrostatic fogger. We're using that on all of the transportation buses, both before and after they're used on every run. We're also using that same material to disinfect any mattresses or personal possessions that people may be bringing with them from one location to another.
Diesel said all prisoners and staff wore masks during the evacuations. U.S. Representative Veronica Escobar of El Paso wants answers after several detainees at an ICE facility accused guards of sexual assault and harassment. KERA's Mallory Falk reports.
The Democratic Congresswoman sent a letter to ICE and the Department of Homeland Security demanding answers about a recent complaint alleging, quote, a pattern and practice of repeated sexual assault and harassment at the El Paso Processing Center. The complaint focuses on 3 detainees, including a woman who says multiple guards forcibly kissed and touched her out of view of security cameras. According to Escobar, there have been 3 new reports of sexual assault at the facility since the complaint was filed earlier this month. Escobar is asking DHS to prevent retaliation against the people who came forward, release those who are still detained and halt their deportation, and preserve evidence. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
A number of Texas colleges and universities are kicking off the fall semester this week with a combination of in-person and remote classes. That includes Texas Tech in Lubbock. President Lawrence Skovanek said in a video, steps have been taken to prevent the spread of the coronavirus on campus.
But the stories of universities being forced to suspend in-person classes after reopening due to outbreaks is a vivid reminder to each member of the Texas Tech University community that we must follow health and safety protocols.
Texas Tech has about 50 active COVID-19 cases. Black and Latino voters in Texas are more likely than white voters to think coronavirus restrictions were relaxed too soon. That's according to a new poll by the Texas Hispanic Policy Foundation, a nonpartisan nonprofit. 61% of the black people surveyed and 55% of Latinos said the state reopened too quickly. In comparison, just over one-third of white respondents held that view. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and a variety of individual courses, including for advanced placement. Learn more about options for the new school year at highschool.utexas.edu.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Scientists around the world are racing to develop a safe and effective vaccine against the coronavirus, but some people have proposed letting the virus infect everyone until a kind of herd immunity is reached. Perhaps you've heard of that idea. But what exactly is herd immunity? Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie reports.
At first glance, letting the virus just burn through the country unchecked until there are no more people for it to infect sounds like an interesting idea. Just throw away our masks, start congregating in large groups, send the kids to school, don't worry about it. Back in March, the president even admitted he'd considered it.
I mean, we had a lot of people were saying maybe we shouldn't do anything, just ride it. They say ride it like a cowboy. Just ride it, ride that sucker right through.
But achieving what scientists call herd immunity without a vaccine could have an incalculable cost. So what exactly is herd immunity, also called community immunity? Dr. Joanne Turner is Vice President for Research at Texas Biomedical Research Institute and Executive Director of the Vaccine Development Center of San Antonio. She likens it to fighting zombies.
So if there's a zombie apocalypse and we haven't heard about it yet, then obviously all of us could get eaten by a zombie, right? And that's the pandemic beginning.
When no one has any natural immunity to a novel virus, we're all vulnerable. But over time, you learn how to protect yourself.
Once you know there are zombies out there, you would put a big fence up around your house or your community to stop them, right? And then nobody is getting eaten by a zombie.
That fence is your community immunity. And if the fence is well built, tall, and strong, everyone behind it is protected. Even those who can't defend themselves from an onslaught of the undead, like babies and older folks and those who can't fight or run very well. They're all protected. They share in the community's immunity. But
one hole in that fence, which is that one person that didn't vaccinate, your zombie's coming in, and then you're going to get eaten by a zombie.
Vaccines could give a population immunity quickly without a lot of people having to get the disease, but only if enough people get them. So what's the alternative? Natural herd immunity. Just ride it on through, as the president said. Dr. Anthony Fauci shared his thoughts about this recently on Instagram Live with actor Matthew McConaughey, and they're grim.
If you look at the United States of America, with our epidemic of obesity, as it were, with the number of people with hypertension, with the number of people with diabetes, if everyone got infected, the death toll would be enormous and totally unacceptable. And that's the reason why we are against saying, let it fly, let everybody get infected, and we'll be fine. That's a bad idea.
So let's say around 70% of the population would have to have been infected with the coronavirus to achieve community immunity. The population of the United States is about 330 million. 70% of that, around 230 million. If 230 million Americans got infected with this coronavirus, several million people would likely die. Many millions more would have lifelong complications. And there's no guarantee that even after all of this sickness and death, we would even have natural herd immunity at all. The apparent reinfection of a man in Hong Kong highlights the uncertainty that exists around how long a person who's been infected with this coronavirus might be protected from reinfection. The man, who had COVID in March, tested positive for a genetically different strain of the virus this month. That suggests that for some, immunity might only last for a few months, making natural herd immunity something that may not even be possible with this disease. Turner says that's why developing a safe and effective vaccine is so important, because this virus can be vicious. And while some populations, like the ones Fauci mentioned, are at increased risk for serious disease, anyone of any age can get serious COVID.
And so am I willing to take that risk by going out and saying, sure, we should all get it, if I'm the one or someone close to me is the one that ends up getting chronic long-term disease or dying from it? I think we can't take that risk personally.
If enough people don't get a vaccine, Turner says, there is a hole in our fence, and the zombies can and will get through. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
You can learn more about vaccines and the science and medicine around COVID-19 with Texas Public Radio's Petri Dish podcast. You can listen and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Many museums and galleries across the Lone Star State have been shuttered since the start of the pandemic, but several have found creative ways to make their collections accessible online. And now that the art world is slowly starting to reopen, some institutions are moving to a hybrid model. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan tells us about one such exhibit, San Antonio's Cinco Artistas, set to reopen September 4th.
That exhibition at Fredericksburg Road's Central Cultural Aztlan is both virtual and actual. Here's Ruth Guajardo.
It's based on five artists, and basically we ask them five questions, and they answer their questions, and then they show us five of their works of art.
They have created a video that will debut on September 4th, and in it they ask five questions to those five artists.
And in the video, their artwork is right behind them as a backdrop. But then at the end of the video, we individually post each piece.
There's a total of 25 pieces and in various media.
We have three painters, one photographer, and one ceramist. She does ceramics. She was trained originally as a painter, but now she's a sculptor and creates clay works.
That video will give a good taste of each artist and their works, but you can actually go see them. Too.
We do have it in display here at the gallery. We are open by appointment. That way there's not, you know, too many people at once.
With the live Facebook reveal of the video and the resulting interactive response, the gallery is hoping to generate some of that sense of community that's been fractured due to COVID-19. I'm Jack Morgan in San Antonio.
COVID-19 has put hospitals back in the headlines. We're constantly hearing which facilities are at or near capacity, where accommodations are available, which regions are in need of more emergency facilities. Indeed, hospitals have become so indispensable we may forget there was a time when hospitals didn't exist. The Standard's Joy Diaz reports on the first hospital ever opened in the Americas, a facility that still serves patients today.
El Hospital de Jesús, or Jesus's Hospital, is in the heart of Mexico City. It opened its doors in 1524. Because of COVID restrictions, I was only allowed to take a few photos and then leave. But as I was getting ready for my visit, my 12-year-old told me just how impressed she was by how old the hospital is.
That survived World War One. World War II.
Actually, the hospital was fully functioning almost 100 years before the pilgrims arrived in America, and it's still in operation. Adrián Humberto Rivera Becerra is the hospital's administrator. He says it's challenging to keep an ancient nonprofit afloat. One challenge arises when donors find out Hernán Cortés, the conquistador, one of the most controversial figures in history for his brutal and violent conquest of Mexico, is the person who founded the hospital.
En el Hospital de Jesús asumimos que las personas como Hernán Cortés.
We at the Hospital de Jesús assume there is goodness and there is evil in every person, as is the case with Hernán Cortés. His evil side is well documented, and we don't deny it. But on his good side, we celebrate how he founded Mexico City and his vision for this hospital.
Adrián Humberto Rivera Becerra is quick to highlight many of the hospital's virtues. From the beginning, back in the 1500s, the hospital has cared for the poorest of the poor. The fact that during its first 200 years, the hospital's chapel was a refuge for escaped African slaves. And also the fact that, from the beginning, it's been a teaching institution to doctors and nurses in training, and still is.
Ahora que empezó la pandemia,
Since the pandemic started, all students were sent home. So now we're teaching online. Doctors are teaching long distance, and we continue to adapt now to these new measures.
When patients enter El Hospital de Jesús, they're treated with the most modern technology available, while the building is a time capsule with intricately carved ceilings with golden accents of crosses and flowers. Bright orange walls lead to open courtyards lined with gray arches. One side of the building is completely covered in murals which depict the history of medicine, and a fountain in the middle of the garden crowns the hospital's courtyard.
De algún modo, la sensación que tiene uno de estar en un lugar que ya va a cumplir casi 500 años.
Working inside a building that's almost 500 years old fills me with pride and with honor. It makes me think of all the people who were here before we came.
As a reporter, it makes me think of all the stories those walls have witnessed. One that caught my attention is the story of an Irish doctor who worked there in the late 1500s. He sailed into Mexico with a crew of pirates. Yes, pirates.
Everyone stay calm, we are taking over the ship.
But in 1575, the doctor was executed by the Catholic Church, not for being a pirate, for being a Lutheran. Another interesting story has to do with the patronage of the hospital. Patron was the title Pope Clement VII gave in perpetuity to Hernán Cortés and his descendants. Most hospital patrons were men, but three women held that title too. And then there's this other story, the one of the multiple exhumations of Cortés' remains. If you've seen recent protests in the United States, where people question the value of preserving the statues of slave owners and Confederate soldiers, protests that often end with toppling those statues, then Rivera Becerra says you'll understand what happened to Cortés' remains over the centuries. First, you must learn Cortés died in his native Spain in 1547.
En el testamento, él...
On his will, he stated he should be buried in Mexico City.
20 years later, and after two exhumations, his remains made it to Mexico.
Viva la America!
But after the Mexican War of Independence, people in Mexico wanted to cut all ties with Spain, and Cortés' remains and the monuments erected in his honor were constantly under threat. So much so that over the centuries, his remains have been exhumed a total of 10 times.
Until they finally arrived at Hospital de Jesús, where he remains.
The same place where other people who have been rejected and abandoned have found refuge and solace for centuries. I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
Well, a real estate developer known for his outsized influence on Houston's skyline has died. The Houston Chronicle reports that Gerald Hines passed away on Sunday in Connecticut. He was 95. The Indiana-born Hines launched his business in Houston in 1957 and went on to reshape the landscape of Bayou City, including the Houston Galleria, Pennzoil Place, and Williams Tower. Outside of Texas, Hines was the driving force behind buildings in Manhattan, San Francisco, and across Europe and Asia. Hines also served as chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas in the early 80s. We're coming up on 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. There's a whole lot more ahead. Stay with us.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
It's the Texas Standard. For more reopening measures to be implemented in Texas during the coronavirus pandemic, Governor Greg Abbott has said that the state's positivity rate for COVID-19 has to be under 10%. But as the Houston Chronicle reports, a recent data dump of 500,000 backlogged test results from private firms has vexed some local officials and health experts over the reliability of this key metric. Kayla Harris is a state politics reporter for the Chronicle and has been covering this story. Kayla, thanks for joining us on the Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Let's first discuss this metric. Governor Abbott says the state's positivity rate needs to be under 10% to reopen more businesses and allow more public activity. The positivity rate being the number of positive coronavirus cases currently in the state, or is it balanced against the number of tests as well? How does that work?
Yes, it's balanced against the number of tests. So it's the percentage of people who are testing positive compared to the total number of people who've been tested for the coronavirus.
And just to be clear, to give us some relative sense of where we are now, we're not at 10%?
No, right now it's at about 16%, but this number has been all over the place. For the past week and a half, it was as high as 25%. It dropped to a little below 11%. This number is kind of crazy because of that testing backlog.
All right, now let's get to that data dump. When did this happen and why?
The state has been dealing with backlogs pretty much since the start of August. There were actually two separate issues. Throughout the month of July, the state had this outdated processing system, and they couldn't process more than 48,000 tests a day, even though somewhere around 65,000 people were being tested every day. Mm-hmm. So that in and of itself created a backlog, about 350,000 tests from July, mostly from July, that impacted numbers that first week of August. But then a couple days later, August 9th, 11th, that area, came this 500,000 test backlog. Those are from private labs. The state says there were some coding errors. Those tests date as far back as March. So it's, you know, when the labs have those tests and they send them over to the state, there could be an extra comma or a problem with the Excel spreadsheet or something like that that doesn't allow the state to track those tests.
Why is this happening? Is there a bottleneck in the data? Are there clerical errors going on? Surely these companies are supposed to be reporting in some kind of orderly manner so you can track what's happening when.
And they are. I mean, the state says, okay, we're trying to report data in this way. The companies have said that, you know, some of them were just mistakes, like the state said that there was an extra question mark or something in the data. Other ones have said, you know, we were reporting it in one way that we thought we were supposed to report it, but then the state asked us to report it in a different way because they were having some sort of problem. So we don't have the exact details, but the result is the same.
So have there been other data dumps like this that have happened? You see sudden spikes in positivity rates. You were talking about how those numbers have been sort of all over the board back and forth.
Right. It's mostly throughout August. Like I said, that early state created backlog that they had kind of made by themselves because of that outdated system throughout July. We haven't really seen the impact of these backlogs until this month. Mm-hmm. The problem is, though, is that, you know, while we're seeing these crazy numbers all over the place now, we also didn't have those data points when those tests were actually conducted. So most of these backlog tests are coming from June and July when the state's numbers really started going up. Right. So that likely indicates that the state's spike of tests, resurgence of coronavirus earlier this summer was worse than we thought.
Where do we stand now, and how much does this data dump complicate our understanding of where we are?
It complicates it a lot, especially last week. There was really no way of knowing exactly what the positivity rate was on a statewide level. Governor Abbott said Sunday he anticipates that this backlog is mostly cleared. The state had also expected, the health department expected that backlog to be cleared around this time. So going forward, we should see more accurate data. But the statewide positivity rate going back to the beginning of the pandemic is really skewed. Mm-hmm. The good thing is that we have other metrics to rely on. So we can look at hospitalizations, which are a lagging indicator. So that's a little complicated, but hospitalizations have been trending downward. That's really, really encouraging. You can see deaths also trending downward. That's encouraging. And then some of the bigger counties that are having the most coronavirus cases are also able to individually track their own positivity rates because they get results from labs. And that data is accurate because they're vetting each of the numbers individually. So you can rely on data from say Dallas County or something like that. That should be an accurate positivity rate. So that is promising as well. It's really just problems at the state level.
Kayla Harris has been running the numbers as state politics reporter for the Chronicle. She's been covering this story. We'll link to her latest over at texasstandard.org. Kayla, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Mr. Wells Dunbar just got through celebrating a birthday, I understand.
Shucks.
Should I not have said anything? Happy birthday to you, sir.
Thank you, David. Thank you, David. Wonderful
Wells
weekend.
Is
good
our
thing
social
that
media
they only
editor,
come
folks.
Once a year. Is that, that's all I'll say with the indulgences.
I hear you.
But good to be
so,
back.
What, and, did you have some fun?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Just, you know, bummed around in a very socially distanced, responsible fashion,
yes.
as everyone should be doing here in 2020. But good to be mm-hmm. back. Talking about vote by mail, you know, obviously a huge story that's not going anywhere, the issues with the Postal Service. Here's the converse to that. An interesting study showing that voting in person may not be quite as dangerous as many have feared. NPR is reporting on this new peer-reviewed study that found that in-person voting in Wisconsin back in April included over 400,000 voters, but did not produce a detectable surge there in coronavirus cases. Mm. Of course, not all situations are different, which is worth definitely keeping in mind. But via Facebook, Melissa Wilbanks Laurel says that while she knows that there will be more people voting in November, when she voted this summer in Austin, the polling station she went to ran it beautifully. Plexi shields, finger cots, distanced lines, super organized and quick. Unless you're in a high-risk category, it felt very safe. However, Elizabeth Andres notes that if you're in a state that requires masks at the polls, like Wisconsin, it's definitively more safe. However, Texas does not. And it is worth pointing out that there was that carve-out for a polling places in the statewide requirements governing mask usage in public. So definitely one that folks are keeping an eye on. And of course, keeping an eye on that Hurricane Laura. I guess, yeah, it is a hurricane now as it grew from a tropical storm into a hurricane. Looking at the headlines here from our friends here at Space City Weather, the headline there, models have trended west with Laura, and that's not good for Houston. Noting that the overnight trends, not good. Everyone in the greater Houston and Galveston metro area needs to be making final preparations mm-hmm. for potential hurricane landfall. So obviously, you know, with 3 years to the day essentially after Hurricane
right.
Harvey made landfall, lots of people keeping an eye on that storm to be sure.
And people still trying to recover from Hurricane Harvey. I don't know if you're seeing this breaking news at DallasNews.com, Dallas Morning News' website. Mm-hmm. American Airlines, the carrier that's based there in DFW, apparently, after 1,500 administrative and support workers already lost jobs, the airline now says it plans to furlough 17,500 workers in October. The airline industry, especially hard hit by this pandemic and the downturn in travel. It's one of many stories we continue to track, the weather being the top one, of course, and we'll have more on that tomorrow. Among other stories, when the Texas Standard continues on the air, we're online 24/7 at texasstandard.org. On behalf of Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard crew, I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.